Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 313 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in today's podcast, I'm going to be talking about an electrolyte abnormality that shows up just very pervasively on in-beam exams. And people get this wrong. Basically, this podcast is going to be useful for everyone taking every exam from step one all the way to step three. If you listen to this podcast, you should really never get a question on this electrolyte abnormality wrong anymore. And really today I'm going to be talking about hyperkalemia. The thing is hyperkalemia, many people are just like, oh, if you have hyperkalemia, how does it show up on an EKG? How do we treat it, right? Unfortunately, your friends at the MDME have started departing quite significantly from that. And they have many, many more things that they care about these days. And again, one thing I'll just say is, again, if you're interested in the, for those of you taking step 2, CK, step 3, I have a course. There's definitely still some spots available for... It's a step 2 CK, step 3 course. It's going to be taking place from the 26th to the 29th of this month. And then on the 25th of this month, I have an MBME test taking strategies course. Again, many people have taken those courses and they've done extremely well on the exams. In fact, like I've seen many people, I've heard the story many times of people right after the course, they take a practice exam and the MBME, their practice exam scores are like really, really high. Their UWorld percent scores go really, really up. So again, if you're interested, just shoot me an email through the website and I'll give you some more information. There are still some spots left, so just shoot me an email and I'll give you some more information ahead of the course. Okay, so basically, right, so what's hyperkalemia? Well, hyperkalemia means that your blood potassium is pretty high, right? For many of you, right, we know that our normal blood potassium should be between like 3.5 and 5, roughly, on MBME exams, right? So... the thing is, if your blood potassium is, you know, over 5, right, the person is going to have hyperkalemia. Although for the most part, you're not going to have really, really bad hyperkalemia. I mean, at least really bad symptoms until your blood potassium starts going above 5.5, above 6 kind of deal, right? And today I will try to give you multiple vignettes that should buttress these hyperkalemia points so that you're very sound with them on MBME exams, right? So what if they give you a question about a patient? So we're going to be talking about essentially causes of hyperkalemia, right? But then we'll be talking about it in different contexts. And I'll try to use vignettes where possible to introduce them, right? So what if they give you a question about a patient? They tell you that this patient's potassium is 7, right? And that this patient has like no symptoms, just came for like a regular checkup with the physician, right? The EKG is stone cold normal and the person's potassium is 7, right? If you see that and they say, oh, what's your next best step in management? What are you supposed to do? Well, I hope you're saying, oh, let's go ahead and recheck the person's potassium levels, right? The thing is, for the most part, if your potassium is 7, you should probably be circling the drain. The person should be having symptoms. The person should be having EKG findings, right? So if you see a person like that and they're not having any symptoms, they don't have any EKG findings, right? Then the person probably, you probably check the potassium from a hemolyzed blood sample, right? Because remember, 98% of the potassium that resides on the inside of us rests inside our cells, right? So potassium is one of the primary intracellular ions. So like if you have a local breakdown of many red blood cells or many muscle cells as you're drawing the blood sample, that's going to raise the local concentration of potassium and that can give you a false reading. Now, what if they give you a question about a person, the person misses their dialysis session, right? And their potassium goes, they have like really, really bad hyperkalemia. Well, what's causing it? Well, again, it's their renal failure that's causing the problem, right? Remember, one of the primary organs that helps you excrete your potassium is your kidneys, right? So if your kidneys are not working and you skip dialysis, unfortunately, you can get hyperkalemia. That's why once a person is on dialysis, they better go regularly, right? If not, those people can get in trouble big time on MBM exams and also obviously in the real world, right? And then if for some reason, right, the person has, they give you a question about like a young female and they tell you that for the last 2 weeks, she's been having shortness of breath, she has altered mental status, her blood pressure is really low, and you notice that she has skin hyperpigmentation, and her potassium is really high, and her bicarb is really low. If you see that, I would really hope you're saying, oh, Divine, sounds like this person has Addison's disease, right? Remember, Addison's disease is a very nice high-yield MBM exam cause of hyperkalemia, right? So why does Addison's disease cause hyperkalemia? Well, remember, in Addison's disease, you make autoantibodies against 21-hydroxylase, right? You pretty much nuke the person's adrenal cortex. When you do that, the sad thing that's going to happen is you're not going to be able to make aldosterone, right? And remember, all of the action with aldosterone, at least a big chunk of the action, is at the level of the principal cell of the collecting duct. Aldosterone makes you reabsorb sodium through the ENaC channel, right? And as sodium is being reabsorbed through the ENaC channel, that causes you to leak potassium, right, into the urine, right? So if a person has an aldosterone deficiency because they have 21, you know, because they have Addison's disease, right? Essentially, they're not going to be able to reabsorb sodium, so they're going to have hyponatremia. They're not going to be able to pee potassium, so they're going to have hyperkalemia, right? And again, remember, aldosterone also makes you leak protons into your urine. If you're not leaking protons into your urine, you'll hang on to those protons, right? You'll have a hypoaldosterone state in a sense. You'll have a metabolic acidosis. To be more specific, you'll have a normal anion gap metabolic acidosis. To be super, super specific, you have a type 4 RTA, right? Whenever you have low aldosterone states, right? So just kind of think of the things that can cause low aldosterone states and you're pretty set, right? So people that have Addison's disease on NBM exams, they tend to have a type 4 RTA, right? So you can already begin to see that your friends at the NBM, they can generate all these beautiful questions from this, right? Like, they can talk about a person that has like congenital adrenal hyperplasia. Well, again, think about it. If a person has congenital adrenal hyperplasia, right? Again, the most common cause is 21-hydroxylase deficiency. Again, if you have 21-hydroxylase deficiency, you're going to be able to make, you're going to make your sex steroids, no problem, right? But you're going to have lots and lots of problems making aldosterone and cortisol, right? So you essentially, you have a primary adrenal insufficiency. Again, when you have that low aldosterone state, you're not going to reabsorb sodium, so you're going to have hyponatremia. You're not going to pee potassium, so you're going to get hyperkalemia, right? You're not going to be able to pee protons, so you're going to get a metabolic acidosis. Again, a normal anion gap metabolic acidosis. Again, to be more specific, a type 4 RTA, right? That's like a hyperkalemic normal anion gap metabolic acidosis. In fact, type 4 RTA is the only RTA that's associated with hyperkalemia on NBM exams. That's very high yield to know for tests, right? And then if a person is, if a person has, let's say they tell you that, oh, you see a person that has been immobile, you know, in the ICU, has been intubated for many, many, many days, right? And the person's potassium is high, right? Or they can tell you that this is an alcoholic that was found down, right? And the person's potassium is high. Or they can tell you that, oh, this is a person that has been treated with chemotherapy for like some kind of hematologic malignancy, and the person's potassium is high. But what's causing the hyperkalemia in those circumstances? Again, that's pretty easy, right? For the person that has been immobilized, again, remember, your muscles are made to move. I'll say that again, your muscles are made to move. When you don't move for a prolonged period of time, your muscles will start breaking down, right? So the person will have rhabdomyolysis. And again, remember, I said 98% of your body's potassium is stored inside cells, right? So the thing that can happen in those circumstances is, as your muscle cells break down, they release all their cell soup into the bloodstream, aka potassium, and that will raise the person's potassium level, right? The alcoholic that was found down, again, if a person passes out for many, many hours, right? Again, that can cause hyperkalemia, right? Because again, their muscle cells are breaking down. They can even give you a person that just ran a marathon, right? Again, if you run a big 26-mile marathon, right? Or 26.2 miles, I can't remember, but whatever, it's around 26 miles. Big feat for whoever does that, right? But basically, you're going to be breaking down your muscle cells. That can cause hyperkalemia, right? They can even give you an MDMA question, ecstasy. Ecstasy can cause hyperkalemia on MDMA exams. Why? Because remember, people take it so that they can get energy for these dance parties and raves. If you're dancing for like 6-7 hours, that's like running a mini marathon, right? That's not going to be good on your muscles, right? That's going to cause hyperkalemia, right? Basically, I'm just trying to give you all the potential scenarios that your friends at the NBM currently test, you know, most of the time with hyperkalemia, right? Or they can give you the question about a person that taking a drug for heart failure, right? And they develop hyperkalemia. You're thinking about spironolactone, right? Spironolactone or eplerenone. Remember, those drugs are one of the drugs that improve survival in heart failure, right? Spironolactone and eplerenone, they are aldosterone receptor antagonists, right? So because they block aldosterone receptors, you essentially be getting, you're going to be using pharmacology to induce a hypoaldosterone state, right? So that's going to cause the person to not reabsorb sodium, and it's going to cause the person to not pee potassium, right? So those people are going to have hyperkalemia, right? They're going to have hyperkalemia, right? Or think about it. If you're taking some kind of ACE inhibitor, right? If you're taking some kind of ACE inhibitor, well, how do ACE inhibitors work? They inhibit angiotensin converting enzymes, right? In the pulmonary capillaries. So you're not going to be able to convert angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2. If you don't make angiotensin 2, then you're not going to be going to the zona glomerulosa of the adrenal cortex to make aldosterone, right? So you're going to get an aldosterone deficiency from that. So that's going to cause hyperkalemia, right? Or if you're taking an ARB, an angiotensin 2 receptor blocker, right? If you're taking an angiotensin 2 receptor blocker, right? Again, that's going to block those angiotensin 2 receptors on the zona glomerulosa of the adrenal cortex. So you're not going to be able to make angiotensin. I mean, you're not going to be able to make aldosterone. And then the person is going to promptly run into trouble on exams, right? Or If, for example, a person is taking an NSAID, right? If a person is taking an NSAID, think about it. NSAIDs inhibit cyclooxygenase, COX-1, COX-2. The thing is, COX-2 causes you to make prostacycline. One of the things prostacycline does in the kidneys is that it actually makes you secrete potassium ions at the level of the distal nephron, right? So the thing is, basically makes you secrete it into the urine, right? So if for some bizarre reason you're taking an NSAID and you inhibit COX-2, right? Especially these COX-2 inhibitors like celecoxib, right? They will inhibit cyclooxygenase 2. You will not make prostacycline, so you will not secrete potassium into the nephron, into the distal nephron. So that potassium will build up in your body, right? So because of that, sadly, you will get a hyperkalemia on NBM exams, right? Or if a person is taking Bactrim, they can give you a question about a HIV patient, right, that is being treated for pneumocystis jervetii pneumonia, and then their potassium begins to rise. Well, why did their potassium rise? Well, think about this. Again, remember I said that in the principal cell of the collecting duct, we have an INEC channel that brings in sodium. As that sodium enters into that principal cell, right, to maintain the principle of electron neutrality, that displaces potassium into the urine, right? So the thing is, if a person is taking Bactrim, trimethoprim sulfur methoxazole, this is actually like something big that happens with sulfonamides. They block that INEC channel of the collecting duct, right? They block that INEC channel of the collecting duct. If you block that INEC channel of the collecting duct, you're not going to be displacing that potassium from the principal cell. So potassium will accumulate in your body and you will get a hyperkalemia, right? If a person is taking an INEC channel blocker like amiloride or triamterin, right? Those are INEC channel blockers that are used, you know, they're used as diuretics, but you can also add them to the hypertensive drug regimen for a patient that has like hypokalemia. Remember, many of these diuretics cause hypokalemia. So these potassium sparing diuretics like amiloride, triamterin, right? If you add them to their regimen, right? Because they are INEC channel blockers, again, you will have nothing, no sodium coming in through that INEC channel to displace potassium ions, right? So if potassium ions are not being displaced, right, you're going to have a hyperkalemia because they're being stored in the body, right? Or if you're using that amiloride triamterin to treat nephrogenic diabetes insipidus associated with lithium use, right, again, whenever you block those INEC channels, you're going to get hyperkalemia as a result of that, right? If a person is taking a beta blocker, right? If a person is taking a beta blocker, think about it. A beta blocker. Remember, we have beta 2 receptors, right? In the body, and when you activate those beta 2 receptors, that actually increases the activity of the sodium potassium ATPase pump, right? So, what does the sodium potassium ATPase pump do? Basically, it takes 3 sodiums out of the cell and puts 2 potassiums into the cell, right? So, if you're taking a beta blocker, you're deactivating those beta 2 receptors, right? You're not going to be taking sodium out of cells, right? And you're not going to be putting potassium into cells. If you don't put potassium into cells, potassium will build up on the outside and you will have hyperkalemia, right? That's why we use beta 2 agonists, right, to treat hyperkalemia, right, as you would see. Another classic one they love to do on NBM exams, they can even give you a question about a person that has neuroleptic malignant syndrome or a person that has malignant hyperthermia. Again, remember, in those circumstances, the person's muscle cells are breaking down. As those cells are breaking down, you're going to be releasing their cell soup into the surroundings. You're going to get hyperkalemia as a result of that, right? Another classic one they love to test on exams, right? If a person, they can give you a question about a person that just took succinylcholine, right? And, you know, this person took, like, it was just intubated. And then not long after they got intubated, their potassium started going up. Again, you really, 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 really want to think about succinylcholine, right? Succinylcholine, when you give it to people, right, it's a depolarizing neuromuscular blocking agent, right? So basically, when it does that, sodium is going to rush into the cell, into the skeletal myocyte, and potassium is going to be displaced. So it can cause hyperkalemia. In fact, this is why people that are like burn patients or rhabdomyolysis patients, they're usually told, don't intubate these people with something like succinylcholine. Why? Because if you're a burn patient, you've killed many cells, right? You've killed many, 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 many cells, right? So those cells are releasing their cell soup into the surroundings, aka potassium, and then the person will get in trouble, right? So the thing is, usually when people get hyperkalemic problems, they get it because you are combining like multiple risk factors for hyperkalemia together, right? So if a person has a burn, you've already killed many cells, so potassium is being released into the surroundings, and then you intubate them with succinylcholine, which causes you to have more potassium being released into your surroundings, right? That's going to cause lots and lots and lots and lots of problems, right? So the person can get a hyperkalemic issue, right? So again, it's just one of those weird high yield things you want to keep in mind. Even digoxin, they can give you a question about a person that has cardiogenic shock, right? Or a person that has AFib, right? Or heart failure that's placed on digoxin, right? And they develop hyperkalemia. Again, how does digoxin work? digoxin inhibits, right? The sodium potassium ATPase pump. If you inhibit the sodium potassium ATPase pump, right? Guess what? You're not going to be bringing sodium out of the cell. You're going to be putting potassium into the cell. So potassium is going to build up on the outside. So you're going to get hyperkalemia, right? So again, there are many, many causes of hyperkalemia on NBM exams that your friends at the NBM love to test. Even if a person has like a metabolic acidosis, right? That can cause hyperkalemia. How's that? Well, think about it. If you have a metabolic acidosis, that means the number of hydrogen ions outside your cell are like astronomically high. Well, if you're astronomically high, well, guess what's going to happen? Your body's going to try to get those hydrogen ions into your cell. Again, to maintain the principle of electron neutrality, as those hydrogen ions go into your cell, they will literally unseat potassiums from inside your cell, and those potassiums will rush to the outside of your cell, right? So you can get hyperkalemia in the setting of a metabolic acidosis, right? Or they can give you a question about a person that was recently placed on immunosuppression because they got some kind of organ transplant, right? And they develop hyperkalemia. Well, think about these calcineurin inhibitors, right? Calcineurin inhibitors like cyclosporine or tacrolimus, right? Remember, those drugs, in addition to being, you know, calcineurin inhibitors, guess what? They also inhibit the sodium potassium ATPase pump, right? So again, if you're inhibiting the sodium potassium ATPase pump, again, you're not going to be bringing sodium out of the cell. You're not going to be putting potassium into the cell. So you're going to develop a hyperkalemia, right? As a result of that, right? Even these, I already talked about trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. It's the trimethoprim part that is the innate channel blocker, again, that causes hyperkalemia. Even this drug that we use sometimes to treat pneumocystis jervetii pneumonia, pentamidine, right? Like pentamidine, aerosolized pentamidine, also inhibits the sodium potassium ATPase pump, right? So that can absolutely cause hyperkalemia on NBM exams, right? And then if a person is being treated for some kind of malignancy, right? If a person is being treated for some kind of malignancy, again, on exams, it's going to be a hematologic malignancy. Again, if you're killing so many cells in one fell swoop, well, the thing that's going to happen is those cells, again, they're going to release their cell soup into the surroundings, right? That can cause hyperkalemia. In fact, many times you need to watch the potassium levels in people that are getting like chemotherapy for like some kind of leukemia or lymphoma, right? Because in this, because essentially they are facing like a double whammy as to what may be causing their hyperkalemia. One, you're killing cells, so they're releasing their cell soup, so you're getting hyperkalemia as a result of that. But the second thing is, you're also literally nuking the kidneys with uric acid, right? Tumor lysis syndrome. You're nuking the kidneys, and your kidneys, guess what? They're the primary organs that help you get rid of potassium, right? So if you're producing more potassium, and then you are ineffectively eliminating potassium, your potassium will build up, and you will get a hyperkalemia as a result of that, right? So again, it's very, very high yield to know this stuff for exams, right? Even if a person is taking octreotide, right? Octreotide, remember, it suppresses the secretion of many hormones. One of the hormones it suppresses the secretion of is insulin, right? Remember, one of the jobs of insulin is that it increases the activity of the sodium potassium ATPase pump. If you take octreotide, that's going to downregulate insulin production, right? So you're going to have less stimulation of the sodium potassium ATPase pump. So potassium will hang out outside of cells and you're going to get in trouble. And again, I remember I said beta blockers, you know, they have the ability to cause hyperkalemia. It's the beta 2 blockers, things that have the ability to block beta 2 receptors that can cause hyperkalemia. If you're a beta 1 blocker, can you cause hyperkalemia? Yes, but it's a very, very minor effect. In fact, for the most part, you can go ahead and take this rule away to NBM exams that beta 1 blockers do not cause hyperkalemia on NBM exams. So you may be like, Divine, why is hyperkalemia bad? Well, think about it. If you know your action potential, you will understand why hyperkalemia is bad, right? Because normally what happens with an action potential, the cell is going to reach threshold, right? And then sodium channels will open, right? When those sodium channels open, sodium is going to, because sodium is primarily an extracellular ion, sodium is going to rush into the cell. It's going to depolarize the cell. And if you depolarize the cell, right, the cell is, you know, the membrane potential is getting more positive, right? But after that, potassium channels will then open, right? And then potassium will rush out of the cell, right? Potassium will literally rush out of the cell to repolarize the cell. So assume that a person has hyperkalemia, right? Remember, for potassium to be rushing out of the cell, that means there must be a gradient. That means, oh, wow, potassium is really high inside the cell and potassium is really low outside the cell. So the potassium will flow out, right? So if you think about it, if you have hyperkalemia and your potassium is really, really high outside your cell, then that gradient for potassium to flow from inside the cell, being an intracellular ion, to outside the cell is not going to be there. If that does not happen, your cells will not repolarize, right? And remember, after a cell has depolarized, the sodium channels get inactivated, right? So think about it. If your cell is not able to repolarize, it's almost like stuck in this depolarized state. So guess what? Your sodium channels are going to stay inactivated. It's almost like you're literally taking like a very, very dangerous dose of an antiarrhythmic, right? Your sodium channels are going to stay deactivated, right? So your cell is pretty much stuck. It's not able to depolarize. It's not able to repolarize again, right? So over time, the person can go into cardiac arrest and go into asystole, right? In fact, typically when a person has hyperkalemia on MDMA exams, right? The first thing that will happen is that you have those tall peaked T waves, right? You have those tall peaked T waves. If the potassium keeps rising, then your QRS complex is going to start getting wider, right? If your potassium keeps rising, then your QRS complex will become like a sinusoidal wave. And then after that, if the potassium keeps rising, the person will sadly go into asystole, right? Person will go into asystole, right? So if a person has hyperkalemia, how do we treat these people? Well, that's actually pretty easy. The first thing you're going to do is you're going to stabilize the cardiac membrane, right? You're going to stabilize the myocardial membrane. Just use some kind of calcium salt, calcium gluconate, calcium chloride, literally whatever calcium salt floats your boat is pretty fine for those people, right? And then the second thing, so the thing is you literally need to follow these steps on MBM exams. I'll say that again. You literally need to follow these steps on an MBM exam, right? So what do you do first? Again, you're going to give calcium gluconate first to stabilize the myocardial membrane. No one really knows why that helps, but the key word to remember is that it stabilizes the myocardial membrane. And then the second thing you're supposed to do on MBM exams is to give insulin plus glucose, right? Again, remember, insulin increases the activity of the sodium potassium ATPase pump, right? I'll say it again. Insulin increases the activity of the sodium potassium ATPase pump, right? So the sodium potassium ATPase pump is going to take three sodiums outside of the cell. It's going to put two potassiums into the cell, right? So that's literally helping you, right? So that's going to treat the person's hyperkalemia, right? You're basically redistributing potassium. So step one, calcium gluconate or calcium chloride. Step two, insulin plus glucose. You're going to be giving the glucose, right? So that the insulin doesn't tank your blood glucose too low, right? You don't want a person having hyperkalemia and hypoglycemia, right? You'll probably surely die if that were to happen. And then the third thing you then give, if that's not panning out on exams, is you give a beta-2 agonist, right? You give a beta-2 agonist. You give nebulized albuterol, right? Again, that increases the activity of the sodium-potassium ATPase pump, right? If that's not working, right, you can give sodium bicarb as a fourth thing on MBM exams, right? Because if you give sodium bicarb, you're going to raise the pH of the person's blood. That's going to attract hydrogen ions out into the bloodstream from cells, right? And potassium is going to go in the other direction. Again, you're trying to redistribute potassium, right? But another thing you can also do on MBM exams is you can give a diuretic, right? But you only give diuretics to people that have intact kidney function. If a person's kidney is not really working well, the diuretics are not really going to do diddly squat for that person, right? So the thing you're going to do is you're going to give a diuretic, right? Because most diuretics, they cause hypokalemia as a side effect. That's obviously a good thing, right? In a person that has hyperkalemia, right? Another thing you can also do to eliminate potassium is you can give K-exalate, right? Remember, K-exalate makes K exit out of your body, right? Sometimes on exams, you may see it referred to as sodium polystyrene sulfonate, right? Sodium polystyrene sulfonate. Usually you conjugate that with sorbitol, right? To help you literally get rid of potassium from your bodies, right? But another way you can get rid of potassium is also to use hemodialysis, right? You can use hemodialysis. In fact, this is a classic MBM exam question. What is the most effective intervention for rapidly lowering a person's blood potassium? It's actually hemodialysis. Hemodialysis is the most effective intervention for lowering a person's potassium. Now, one thing I guess I want to maybe go ahead and talk about at the end of this is this weird condition. This is probably more so for something that, you know, pop up on step one, right? And the thing is, this is actually a condition. It's a genetic condition that causes a hyperkalemia, right? And the big thing you want to remember here is this disorder. So they'll give you a question about a person that this person exercises, right? Like, and after they exercise, they start having like altered mental status and all these bad things. And then they tell you that, oh, they come into the hospital, they may subject them to like some kind of stress, you know, some kind of exercise. And then they measure the potassium after the person exercises and they notice that the person's potassium is really, really high, right? The person is almost like paralyzed after exercise. So basically think about it, like these people, they live periods of their lives where they're normal. Whenever they exercise, that exercise is then accompanied by paralysis. If you see that, I want you to think about something called hyperkalemic periodic paralysis. Hyperkalemic periodic paralysis, right? So it's actually an autosomal dominant condition, like a chromosome 17 problem, right? So what exactly happens? Essentially, these people, Because again, I literally described the action potential, right? When you have an action potential, your sodium channels open, sodium rushes into the cell, and then your potassium channels open, potassium rushes out of the cell, right? So the thing that happens in hyperkalemic periodic paralysis, right, is that these people, their sodium channels, especially when they exercise, their sodium channels open, but they are very slow to close. So, and like, let's say normally like 500 sodium ions enter into the cell, right? But because these people's sodium channels are very slow to close, instead of 500 sodium ions coming in, let's say like 1 million sodium ions coming. I'm just using numbers to, you know, to really help you understand. If a ton of sodium ions come in, well, guess what? Those sodium ions, they're going to displace potassium ions into the circulation, right? Because again, you want to maintain that principle of electron neutrality, right? So that's why those people get that paralysis, right? Again, I've kind of talked about how your cells stop working when your potassium is really high outside the cell, right? Because that gradient for potassium efflux is gone, right? So I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. And again, as I do at the end of every podcast, I'll talk about a quick life lesson today, actually, right? So as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams, step one, step two CK, step three, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. If you're a medicine resident, I tutor for the medicine board exams and the medicine in training exam, right? So if you want to work with me one-on-one, just shoot me an email through the website. Again, typically people have to book their sessions ahead of time. There are certain times during the year, like now, for example, where my schedule is booked out tutoring wise, like 3 to 4 weeks out, like literally, like right now, I essentially don't have any tutoring availability until like June of next month, essentially like second week in June, pretty much. So if you know that you will need tutoring for your exams, just reach out to me early so that the sessions are booked early, right? Because again, there are literally times where I can't accept new students. And then again, I also offer these comprehensive courses for step two CK slash step three. Again, the MBME test taking strategies course as well. So if you're interested in those, again, I have some of those courses coming up at the end of the month. Just shoot me an email and I'll be more than happy to give you some more information on cost and things like that. And then as ERAS is slowly creeping upon us, again, I do a lot of one-on-one work with people for mock interviews, recommendation letters, personal statements, editing the ERAS applications, although some of those, that work is done offline. But if you're interested in any of those things, just again, shoot me an email through the website. I've worked with people that I've matched into very competitive disciplines, right, with very tricky applications, right? Even people that normally don't match into certain disciplines, right? I've helped them match into those disciplines, right? So if you have like red flags and stuff like that, again, just reach out to me. I've worked with many, many people that have even failed USMLE exams and now they're residents, right? So again, if you're interested in any of those things, feel free to reach out to me. Even for one-on-one tutoring, I've worked with many, many people that their scores have bumped up 40 points or 30 points and stuff like that, right, on their USMLE exams, right? So again, if you're interested in any of those things, reach out to me. So my quick life lesson today is pressing through the crowd, right? Pressing through the crowd. What do I mean by pressing through the crowd? Pressing through the crowd means, because think about it, if you're running through a crowd, right, it means that you're facing a lot of resistance, right, to getting from point A to point B, right? It's much easier to run on a road where there is no one than to run on a road that's like filled with tons of people, right? It's kind of like, let's say you're trying to run into like a technology store on Black Friday, right? There's going to be lots of people in your way, right? But you know that you want something very precious in that store for a very ridiculous price, right? So you're literally willing to press through that crowd to get to the other side. So the thing is, how does this apply to our lives? The thing is, if there is anything worthwhile achieving in life, you're going to have to press through some kind of crowd. Right? That kind of crowd can be an internal crowd, like your own doubts, like your own feeling insecure and things of that nature. Or it can be an external crowd, like naysayers, people that keep talking you down, that keep telling you how foolish you are, that keep telling you how dumb you are, right? It can even be crowd of circumstance, right? Like, for example, growing up in Nigeria, right, we had situations where I remember one famous time where for 9 months we did not have electricity, right? Being able to study and succeed on a high level in like the equivalent of high school in the US, right, required pressing through that crowd of having to use like a kerosene lamp or using a candle to study, right? So the thing is, whenever you have something great that you need to achieve, there will be crowds in the way, right? Like, for example, you know, for people, again, many people know that, you know, I'm a Christian, right? If you remember that blind Bartimaeus, right? When blind Bartimaeus was blind and he was looking for his healing, what was he doing? He was yelling through a crowd. It was like, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me, right? He was not backing down. People kept trying to tell him to back down, but he did not back down. He kept pressing through that crowd. And at the end of the day, Jesus heard him, right? Well, if you remember, there was this man, I think, in the New Testament that was paralyzed from birth. What did he have to do to get his healing? There was a lot of crowd. So what did he do? He broke through the roof, right? And even the Bible says that Jesus saw their faith, was like, oh, gee, wow, these people, they really need their healing, right? So they broke through that crowd. And because they were able to press through that crowd, right, they were able to get their miracle, right? Or even the woman with the issue of blood in the Bible, right? Again, did she just like see Jesus like, oh, hi, Jesus, come here and help me? No. She had to break through a crowd, right? She had to literally break through a crowd to get to that thing that she wanted, right? Even there's this part of the Bible that says that it's the narrow gate that leads to life, right? Like, a narrow gate is a gate that there's a lot of opposition around it. It's something where you have to like wiggle your way through many things, right, to get to that big destiny, right? So I'm encouraging you today, press through that crowd, right? Go through that narrow gate. I mean, I love when Paul says in the Bible that, you know, I press on towards that mark of the upward calling of God in Christ Jesus, right? So, like, he's literally pressing on, right? You don't press through something that is easy. You press through something that is hard, right? You literally press through something that is hard. So I'm going to encourage you today, just keep pressing on, right? Keep pressing on, right? Because, again, if you are going to walk through anything that is really good in life, there is going to be a crowd that is going to try to hold you back, right? In fact, there's this part of the Bible that says that, oh, that a great and effective door has been opened towards me, but there are many adversaries, right? Again, I'm telling you, if you're trying to achieve something big and you don't see any opposition along the way, check the thing you're trying to achieve. It's probably not worthwhile, right? Many good things in life require you to press through a crowd to get to the other side. So thank you for listening to this podcast. Again, this podcast is super high yield. Like, literally, if you know what, understand everything. And again, I try to not like just give you like stuff like less. Oh, these are the drugs that cause hyperkalemia, blah, 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 blah. No, right? I gave you drugs and then I described mechanisms, right? So if you know this, I will be very shocked if you ever got any hyperkalemia question wrong on your test. So thank you for listening to this. I'll see you in the next episode. God bless you. Thank you.